Welcome back to another episode of the Skits and Giggles podcast. For this one, we dive deep into the afterlife with Reto Abishaw. However, in this instance, the afterlife is not a promised existence in your favorite spiritual realm. No. The afterlife is the name of Reto's homemade carbon enduro bike that he also rode at the recent Best Ride of the Year in Thun. We get the all-access, behind-the-scenes look of what it's like to make your own carbon bike at home, the many frustrations and challenges along the way, key design decisions, insights into future improvements and, of course, the feelings of riding a bike you made yourself for the very first time. It's been almost 2 years since we first sat down with Reto to talk about his carbon workshop projects, and it was fun catching up on the process of actually finishing the enduro bike he just started when we first talked. For more information about this episode and the Skits and Giggles podcast, you can just follow the links in the description. To support the podcast, please share this episode with your riding buddies, or just leave us a 5-star rating on your favorite platform. That's it, that's all, Skigglers, and here's our chat with Reto Abishaw. Welcome back to the Skits and Giggles podcast, Reto Abishaw, better known as Mr. Sleeping Awake on Pink Bike and other social platforms. Amongst us at Skits and Giggles HQ is known as the legend. How are you doing tonight?
Doing fantastic. Thanks for having me back.
Bryson, how are you doing tonight?
Very well. I'm also very excited. It's a pleasure to have you back, Reto, and great to see you again, Pascal. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, very well. Very excited for this one tonight. I think before we start with anything else, we need to talk about the best ride of the year. How good was the best ride of the year, Reto?
It was the best.
Woo! Woo!
No, it was such a good day. We got super lucky. The rest of the season was like always super wet, but we didn't really get rained out at all during the best ride of the year. It was still muddy. Conditions were great though. Vibes were high, and
no bad trails.
Cool to discover. Yeah, no bad trails. It was super cool to discover a new riding area, and together with some awesome people make some cool friends, connections there, and get a face to some familiar voices. That was really cool. So,
one special thing about that ride actually was you brought your very special bike.
I did bring my very special bike.
And people want to hear more about that special bike. Right, for context, episode 48 is the first time we did talk to Reto about his homemade carbon bikes. And at the time, he was really only just getting started with his own enduro bike. And today, it's almost 2 years later, Reto actually brought this homemade carbon enduro bike to the best ride of the year to much Stoke reception. And people were very curious about the bike, me included. And that's why we're sitting back down to talk about the completion of the project. And I give it back to Bryson because, sorry, I interrupted.
No, we share this. We share the pain. But yeah, no, let's throw it back. You have the bike now. I've been riding with you a few times, actually. We've been riding since we met. We've been riding quite a couple times this year and last year. We're getting to know Plafayne together, Cousinberry. Oh, well, you're from the region, so you're actually just showing me. But yeah, finally you're on your bike. I've seen you ride it. I saw you at the Best Ride of the Year riding it. And just give us your overview. What's going on with the bike right now?
It took a long time to finish. There were a lot of ups and downs emotionally. And yeah, I feel like every part of the bike I built at least 3 times because I failed in the process. But in the end, I think this is just what makes the experience of the first ride even better, isn't it? And the goal was to take it to Whistler last year, and that didn't happen just because things got away from me. And I had to finish it after my Whistler vacation. Can't really be too mad about going to Whistler anyway. It was a still awesome bike. probably better option anyway, so don't want to break anything on your vacation. And yeah, finished it over winter time and in spring. And now I have a couple of rides on it, and working out pretty well. I don't know where to start, actually.
Let's start with a feeling.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Let's start with a feeling. How good was the feeling after 2 years of, you know, squirreling away in your shed and multiple failed attempts, and then taking it out for a ride and the head tube didn't snap?
Still didn't. I checked for cracks as well the other day. There's still no cracks, so that's made me sleep better. No, the feeling was just cool. I remember building it up in the workshop, and it's getting late. Just put it up in the workshop, leaned it against the table saw, and just stepped back and looked at it. And it's just like, you know, it's a new bike day. Everybody gets excited for new bike days, I think. But there's just like a little more to it, because you were working hard. You put in a lot of effort. So it was really rewarding. And then the first ride, I guess, technically was just back from the workshop back home. And then the next day, straight to Guzambeo, which is some real trails. Rode with my buddy there, and I was pretty nervous on the way up. It's a good pedal uphill. The uphill is on a fire road, and then there's some good single tracks on the way down. Snapped a couple of pictures on the top, and then yeah, you just start rolling. I told myself to take it super easy and, yeah, no, don't overcook it. But as soon as I was on the bike, I felt comfortable and just kind of confidence inspiring. It's just kind of cliche and sounds stupid, but I was definitely riding a lot faster than I should have. And it worked out. So I don't know. It's
still in one piece.
Yeah, the bike is, and it's kind of overwhelming even to think about it. There is just a lot that happened, and it's kind of hard to put these emotions into words. But
I can imagine you were listening to every little sound it made as you crawled up the fire road while you're rallying down the trail. You were kind of like taking in the motion of the way the bar moved, how it was pivoting. But it's not a completely fresh build. You had some familiar components on there. So you grabbed the wheels from your other bike and the brakes, right?
Yeah, wheels and brakes are from other bikes. And then drivetrain as well is even stolen from my other bike. I didn't want to go too far in terms of investment somehow before I knew it worked out. So I stole these components off of my other bike. And yeah, one would think so, like, but I think the first ride, I didn't think much. It was just like way too overwhelming to really think about all these little things.
Mm-hmm.
That only really came during the rides after that.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. I think the first ride, it was just like
relief.
Joy, relief, yeah. Yeah. And like huge amounts of stoke, but I didn't go beyond that, I don't think. There's only so much mental capacity I have, so
but now that you've been on it a few hours, like cumulative, where would you, I mean, the latest bike you could compare it to was your Obeya, and how would you, I mean, it's not a great comparison because they're really different bikes, but what's your comparison on these latest two?
So for context,
because in our last time you said you're probably going to build a bike that's slightly worse than something you can buy. So I'm hoping you're proving yourself wrong. Sorry if I'm loading right now.
it definitely doesn't hold me back. And I was pretty stoked yesterday during the ride. My body looked at me at the bottom and also told me, like, I feel like you're faster on the new bike than on the Rallon. So, you know, probably subconsciously you push it a little more because you want that to be true as well. I don't know, maybe. But it's the bike is definitely faster than I am. So that's already good. It's definitely not holding me back. The suspension is not dialed yet. I have to invest some more time there. I have to really do some bracketing. But I was kind of hoping to have like some better conditions, a little tackier, drier conditions to really dial that in, to have a little bit more braking traction as well. And just I could hit lines repeatedly more. Yeah, just to have less out like variables due to slipping all over the place, sliding all over the place. So I didn't really do that. I constantly fiddled a little bit with the dials, and I think I'm getting closer, but I kind of lost track.
What Pascal, he's about? A tickler, certified.
He's a tickler. Yeah, that's That's why you guys get it all.
That's
so
why we
well.
Hit it off. But yesterday I was on the ride yesterday, and we didn't time anything, and we were in a group, and we were just having fun. But I definitely noticed that you had a lot more confident because earlier, and you know what, you were riding the same tires as what you were riding on your previous bike, so I can see directly.
Yeah,
like,
you're old now, so
yeah, and they're even more worn out because they've been down Whistler for a few days, and. Yeah. You definitely had more confidence. Like you had more confidence given that you were running like worse tires, but also that's why I brought up this idea of you porting over some of the familiar components, because the way I see it is like you're eliminating some of that kind of like variables where you can say like, this and that with the bike when, you know, like the same way that they do like the field test on Pink Bike and stuff. They use all the same tires and wheels or whatever it is that they kind of like more or less even the playing field so they can analyze or report on the suspension movement and the feeling it gives them minus the tire equation. Because that's a huge thing, right?
Yeah.
But anyways, you definitely appeared more confident. And I mean, it just showed in your riding as well.
Yeah, I never looked at it from this way, but I guess that's a fair point. And that's usually what we try to do in engineering at work as well. You only change like one variable at a time, and then you run the tests and see the outcome. It's also like it's a big bike and it's made for the terrain we have here. And it's a very different bike than the Rallon. The Rallon I ride is also the older generation with the 150 millimeters of rear wheel travel. And I mean, it's not a small bike by any means, the Rallon, and it's definitely not slow. But with the high pivot design, this high pivot suspension layout, and also coil, the traction is just really, really good. And in the conditions we had here, it was constantly wet, constantly grimy. I think that really, really helps. So I really like how it behaves in these conditions. It's also funny because I was slightly worried that I have fairly high anti-rise numbers. When I pull the rear brake, the rear suspension should compress or does compress on the rear braking. And I was kind of worried that the suspension would firm up too much in these conditions under these circumstances. But so far, that has not really been a problem, and kind of controlling the chassis movement has been really nice. I don't know. It just works out. I had a couple of points where I wasn't exactly sure how they would behave, but overall I'm mostly happy with these things, so got lucky, I guess.
I guess what we also should do is kind of paint a mental picture for listeners what you actually try to achieve. What maybe can you describe a little bit the design of the overall bike, what kind of the key standout things and choices that you've made when you started the project?
I went out to design a bike that was just made for the terrain I love to ride. And that is mostly rough, steep, rooty, gnarly mountain bike trails. And I was absolutely happy to have a bike that maybe isn't the most poppy or like agile bike. I just wanted to have a plow bike. So this is what I set out to do. And I landed on a high pivot design. I have a good 160 millimeters of rear travel with a nearly fully rearward axle path, combined with a 170 millimeter fork. I have a fairly long reach of, I think, 490 millimeters. And a very steep C-tube angle of 80 degrees. And a very slack 63-degree head tube angle. I was happy to have a little bit more weight, carry that around. Yeah, so as I mentioned, like most of the riding we do here is up fire roads. I don't intend to use it too often for like single track climbing and stuff like that, or like cross country loops. So that went out the window. As a design compromise, I'm gonna use a different bike for that. I did ride it on cross country trails, and it's absolutely hilariously bad. So that was kind of cool to see as well.
It's probably like a waterbed.
Yeah, it feels like a course ship or something. It's kind of hard to navigate through trees.
Okay. So you mentioned high pivot designs. There's obviously a couple of those out in the market today. But overall, what was kind of the inspiration of the design you were going for?
Yeah. When I started designing it, I think the Forbidden Druid, the first generation, just came out halfway through my first sketches. And that kind of encouraged me to go with the high pivot design, because I felt like, okay, if it works for even a smaller trail bike, the drag of the idler or things like that shouldn't really be a problem. And when I started this design, like, there were the first high pivot bikes popping up again, but they weren't nearly as popular as that, or as they are now. I tried to come up with a suspension layout and had some other bikes as inspiration, and then I got a license for Linkage, the suspension design CAD software, and you can do some absolutely beautiful stuff. And then you start like designing, like 3D modeling the bike, and then you realize, oh, there's absolutely no way I can fit all these bearings around the bottom bracket and around the cranks and stuff like that. And then I kind of go back and forth between the two programs and start from there. But when I started, I also had like not much understanding, or I just had some basic understanding of how suspension should work, and you kind of read up on all of that, and you kind of make it work.
So you have a upside down horsed link,
or yeah, what was exactly. It's basically a horsed link design, but it's upside down. So usually a horsed link has a pivot on the chainstay, and I have a pivot on the seat stay, and the rocker link is attached to the chainstay. Then I have a shock tunnel through the C-tube where the shock is driven from the rocker link. I guess it's kind of hard to put in words, but it is the same suspension layout as the new Forbidden the Dreadnought, which made me kind of happy. So I was ready to drop money on a I was ready to drop money on a Dreadnought in case my bike wouldn't work out. So
and we'll actually, I want to get to the reasons why, but first I want to ask you two questions. One is, so we've been to the Best Ride of the Year. We've gone on some group rides. You've definitely have some people ask you some questions about your bike, but what's been like the number one question?
The number one question is probably from non-core mountain bikers that look at the bike and ask me what that idler does. And then that's kind of hard to explain. I don't know what would oftentimes it just like get asked like, oh, you made it yourself. It's like, how? And that's also kind of hard to put in words, or like at least in two sentences.
Well, we can explore that.
How much time do you have?
How much time do you have?
Yeah, in a long format here. Like,
episode 48. Give it a listen.
Episode 48.5.
Yeah. It really depends who you talk to, I guess. Sometimes you can just like nerd out over a little detail.
Mm-hmm.
A few people ask me if I painted it myself as well, which I did, and I think it looks good from afar. I tend to see all the little imperfections, so I'm not. That's one of the things I'm not super stoked about, the paint job.
And what name did you paint on this bike?
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. Oh, that was such a journey just to pick a name. Naming products is so hard. But whenever I heard like a good word, like a striking word, I thought that could work as a name.
Like bright brown?
I wrote it down. Yeah, like bright brown. I wrote it down. I had a whole list, and in the end, I picked Afterlife. I thought that was kind of fitting, because after so much time in the workshop and not thinking about any other projects, I can start to have a life again. So,
well, I mean, I guess there was at the Best Ride of the Year. There was a couple of, the good thing was there was also other frame builders and other fellow tinkerers present. And I guess some of the questions and discussions were pretty technical.
For sure.
I did hear an offer to buy one, but I think we won't see the light of that, I guess.
No, definitely not. There's, you can make one bike and that's one thing, but if you want to start to produce them in a small series, or like if you want to make multiple, like to sell, first of all, I would definitely not feel comfortable selling it to somebody without any fatigue testing. I don't think it's gonna break right away, or the head tube snaps off. But you never know, and you kind of want to make sure before you hurt somebody else even more so than yourself. So there's that. And then what are the chances they want the exact same size? So the molds would already be out the window, and then there's so much more to it. So
absolutely. But it was funny on that parking lot where we all standing around the bike, and technical chatter going back and forth, and a lot of interest, and
what, you did this yourself? Oh my god.
it was really cool.
I was pretty happy about that. The goal for me was to have a bike that doesn't look homemade. It was always the goal to have something that looks factory, and you can't just like tell obviously, oh yeah, that's a shop made bike. So I think I got pretty close to that. So,
all right. Well, so that is now the feel-good story so far. Mm-hmm. That, you know, you came around, you had the idea, it all worked out. The head tube didn't snap so far. And that is all very, very feel-good. But let's talk about some of the low points.
Yeah.
There was some manufacturing mishaps.
There were some mishaps. I remember seeing different pink bike posts and social medias and all the rest of it of things having gone not too great.
Because you started out with an idea.
Please elaborate.
Yeah, you started out with an idea to manufacture it. And then you decided something else, right?
Yeah, well, that was just like out of necessity, because at some point, if you try the same thing over and over again and it doesn't work out, you know, I should probably change something at some point. So the whole project, I mentioned the suspension. So I never designed a mountain bike suspension before. So you start reading up on that and you make up something there. And you figure it out over time, you know. But the whole project, like every part of the project, was basically that exact same process. It was out of my comfort zone, out of my wheelhouse, for many of the steps. I felt pretty confident in the 3D modeling part, because I think this is one of the things I do well and is one of my strengths. But then making a part like that, or like parts like that, is fairly complex, out of carbon fiber. There are some really challenging things, and if I had to redesign a bike again, it would definitely not have a shock tunnel. Just because that just added so much complexity and so much frustration into the process. I struggled a lot with the manufacturing part, and learned a lot. I built carbon fiber negative molds to laminate the front triangle with a pre-preg carbon fiber inside these negative molds, and the molds worked out okay. I have a bit of experience with the mold making, so that was less of a problem. But then this was by far the most complex parts that I made in carbon fiber. And just to give you some context, you know, typically if you have a mountain bike frame built in a factory, you have like a complete kit, like all the sheets of carbon fiber are pre-cut on a CNC plotter, and you have a stack of all pre-cut things, and this is all engineered already. So I kind of made it up on the go. I had a layup that I designed or specified, but then exactly what shape every individual patch had, I kind of had to adjust that on the go, and that takes just a lot of time. And laminating the front triangle took about 35 hours of time, just to get all the layers in place and everything well compacted and put in place. So when I closed the mold and pressurized the bladders, and I had a leak in the bladder, and it's on the inside of the bike frame, and you can't do anything about it anymore because the molds are closed, the overlaps in the pre-pregs are sticking to each other, and when you rip it open, you just like destroy the whole process. So I wasted a whole lot of fairly expensive raw material, and like 35 hours down the drain, start cleaning the molds and reapply release agent. Did that two times. The third, I had to make the front triangle three times before it worked out. So the third one finally worked, adjusted some things, and ended up making a heavy silicon bladder that already has like the inside shape of all the, like the silicon bladder has the shape of the void inside the front triangle basically. So, and it's very sturdy because it's like 2 millimeters of silicon, and it doesn't break as easily, and it's very flexible. So in the end, I had to go down this route. I had to make that bladder as well, which I tried to avoid and use some basically vacuum bagging film. But the problem is, once you can't really place it correctly or perfectly inside the closed mold, because once the mold is closed, you can't access anything. And then if you have some breaching in like a sharp corner, then it's just like easy to pop that that vacuum back. So there was a lot of things like that, and even machining little bits on my CNC router. With every CNC program that you write, you just gain an experience and become more proficient with it. But I basically built the CNC as well to make that bike. So it's not like I have a ton of experience with machining stuff, and yeah, so it has been a struggle and a challenge, but it was even though it was frustrating in parts, it was very rewarding. So
did you do everything on your own, or did you get some help when frustration levels were too high?
I talked to a few smart people, but I think I'm way too stubborn to ask for help with these projects sometimes. I think there would be an easier way, but for me, it's kind of part of the process. It's just like struggle through a little bit as well. And there's also, there's fairly little information out there on the specific process I used. So it was kind of hard to find the right people even to ask about advice. The people I would have access to, they could, or like there is very smart people I could talk to, but then they can give you some advice how it would be done in the industry if you want to make 1,000 parts, which is not necessarily applicable to me. So it's always finding the right balance. And I certainly talk to a lot of people, like informally, and got some advice, but, probably should have talked to more. Can never hurt, really. But.
Mm. But, the funny thing is, I guess that's, also for context, right? So it's also, your professional life is also composites.
Yeah, somewhat tangent.
Yeah, but at least you have a network available to you and some experience and contacts, etc. that you could lean onto.
Yeah, so I work in the composite industry. I don't work with composites per se too much anymore professionally, but I am responsible for the engineering of like production lines to make composite materials. So but it's not like I'm in a laminating parts every day anymore or things like that. So there's a lot of experience I was lacking, definitely. So
for sure. I was also not 100% serious. Let's not overthink this. Bryson, you had a second question that you wanted to ask, so I'm bringing it back to you.
Oh no, it was answered.
Uh-huh.
No. Actually, the second question was, because based on the first one, what people were asking you about, what was like the number one question, in terms of you, what was actually the hardest part? Like the single hardest part to do, let's say.
Yeah.
In comparison, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So the one I struggled with the most was definitely the front triangle. Just because it is a fairly complex shape, and it's also like highly structural, so you really don't want it to go like you don't want to take any shortcuts there. So, but I also struggled a lot with the painting, and painting is just like a whole different. Yeah, it's nearly like it could be a profession or something like that.
Like it might be.
It might be. Right. It's hard, and with the painting, I don't really have access to a paint job or anything. So you kind of do it in my personal workshop, but it's just dusty. Nothing is prepared for. I use a shitty air compressor, and then you don't have the proper filters in place, so you end up with some moisture in the compressed air, and then you have some fish eyes, and and then there is so much sanding involved. It's just absolutely nuts. So I have a lot of respect for people who can get like perfect paint jobs on bikes. Now even more so than before. So, that was kind of a lot of
spoken as a real.
It's also pretty bad because you feel like you're on the final stretch of the project, and it's just like throw on some paint. But I always also had like that goal to make it look factory, and this is all make or break by the paint job. So, you kind of want to get it out of the workshop and start writing, but at the same time it's like, if I spend a couple more hours sanding primer, then it's gonna look better. And yeah, so, and the paint is already chipping in a couple of places, so
Back to your topic of the hardest part, or one of the hardest parts being the front triangle itself. We just talked very briefly on the episode 48 about the layup, and you know, there's a couple rules of thumb in terms of the directions that the carbon fibers go in terms to create like a good layup for strength and, you know, torsion ability and things like this. Did you, through your findings and your working out the solutions, did you come up with some novel solutions, or like maybe some things that are probably done in the industry as far as you know that you use specifically for the bike that really made the difference?
Yeah, so I think with the layup, I didn't really look for anything out of the ordinary. I did some funky layups on previous projects when I built skis. Tried some new stuff that worked out well, and they are ridiculously light and hold up. But with the bike, I did some reverse engineering of another carbon frame. That I cut down, and if you cut out a little coupon, and you can burn away the resin with a blowtorch, and the carbon fiber doesn't burn away, so you can separate the layers. And if you have a precision scale, you can even figure out the surface weight of each individual layer, and you can see the fiber orientation. So I learned a lot from that. Just to see what is done on other bikes. There's a broken bike that I cut up, and then you just have some specific requirements. For example, so I have the shock mount is on the down tube, and just because of that, I have a bending load on the down tube. And if you have the shock mount just at the bottom bracket area, for example, then the down tube wouldn't see that bending load that pushes, that tries to break your or bend your down tube. So I beefed it up quite a bit and have a much chunkier layup than the reference that I cut up. And you do some back of the envelope calculations, and then have a safety factor of 2, and then you call it a day. So.
And now the bike weighs 37 kilos.
Well, yeah, I was actually like comparing it yesterday to my friend's new Raw Madonna, and like just in the parking lot without a scale, mine felt still lighter than the Madonna, which is not saying much, but
yeah, still.
I'm pretty happy on how well it pedals. I think I never hit really more than a good 1,000 meters of vertical in a day, but like I think on a it's definitely worse, slightly worse than the Orbea Rallon, but it's not like night and day either, so I'm happy to pedal it around all day. So yeah, not too bad.
It's purpose built.
Yeah, exactly.
So listening to you talk about having to build the equipment so you can build a bike, I kind of had this idea in my mind. And did you ask yourself like a very one very specific question at the beginning of this endeavor? You know, you had this idea to make your own mountain bike. Of course, you previously built your own road bike. Different story. But when you said to yourself, I'm going to build a mountain bike, what kind of questions went through your head?
Yeah, I was kind of considering building a hardtail just because it's easier, basically. And I did talk to Vlad. He used to make an awesome downhill bike from carbon fiber as well. And he is now, if I'm not mistaken, the designer. We are one, exactly. Really cool dude.
Yeah, I believe Flood, the original design of his downhill bike, that's what they're using still as the basis of the current World Cup bike that VR1 is developing.
Yeah, exactly. From what I understand, they cut up an arrival and then glued it back together with the geometry they wanted and called it a downhill bike. Yeah, and there you go. It looks simple as that. So clean. So they did a good job with that. Yeah, yeah. So I talked to him and he was like, "Listen, you're gonna spend so much time building it, might as well just really build the bike you want and not just like make a hardtail just because it's easier."
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so I guess I went
the question in my mind, because I'm listening, like I remember back when we did the last pod, you mentioned that there's tons of stories with your dad and growing up in a house where, you know, it was available to do shop stuff and work with your hands and there's tools in abundance. And I kind of have the feeling you kind of just walk around and you're like, can I build that? And then you look at something else and you're like, could I build that?
Yeah.
The answer is yes, right?
Well, that's the thing what I learned over time, you know, like I think most people can could build a lot more than what they think they can. And with the bike as well, like when I started, I didn't have the skills to build the bike, but you build the skills on the way. And now I do. So you kind of grow with the project. Sounds like a Bauhaus commercial, but it's kind of true. So,
yeah, but it's the same with everything, right? So it's the same with you know, with our little podcast. If you listen to our first 5 episodes, you're gonna be like, "Dang, those guys are never gonna make it to 10 episodes." And look at us, we're here. It's you know, this is gonna be 81, and we're still learning. We're trying new things. Exactly. Or we're just stupid. That could also be.
Yeah. But some blissful ignorance helps as well. So.
Exactly. The right kind of stupid.
Yeah. Exactly.
So Pascal, I've got two more. Potent questions, but before I kind of like crack on with those, is there anything you want to are you still curious about something about Reto's bike and what and his journey so far? Because I want to throw a spin on this whole debacle.
All right, cool. So then I throw my last one in.
Sure.
Because I already asked it on the best ride of the year, but I think we want to capture it forever. Is, you know, what kind of things, you know, of course, your project is finished. You're like super stoked that the head tube didn't snap in the first thing. And then you're going like, okay, so how am I going to make it better?
Yeah.
So what are the things you're going to work on?
Ooh-wee.
Well, there's always stuff. And especially when you have a project, you know, this is just, it says prototype on the side. So I guess that's an excuse for everything. But you learn stuff on the way, and whatever project it is, by the end of the project, it's never like you're never 100% satisfied. So there might be a new rear end coming at some point. For now, it's working well, but there is a couple of things I think I could improve. One of the things would be a heel clearance. So I have a little less heel rub, kind of minor. But also just like visually, I think I could make it a little more interesting. I could also directly integrate a lower idler pulley into the chainstay. And that could maybe help shifting performance, which is not great right now. I'm not 100% sure why that is, but I talked to Stefan Lorenz from Scar Cycles, and he told me as well that, or he mentioned that, that they had some poor shifting performance on high pivot bikes without a lower idler. And I would also be curious to have maybe a floating brake mount option, just to see what that would do. But I'm not sure I would go this far. So yeah.
Remember Vlad's advice.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Just build it.
Yeah, but it probably also comes with some downsides. Spent so much time. It probably also comes with some downsides. I think probably the stiffness of the brake mount would be a lot it would be a lot less stiff, so I would be worried that comes with a lot of brake noise just because of some weird vibration resonances and stuff like that. So
not the good vibrations.
Yeah and honestly I'm not sure how I would integrate it into the current design. So
but I mean, what is cool, I mean, obviously I've seen it and I'm sure we're going to put photos up on the Instagrams with this episode so people can have a look too. But I mean, it's, I think there's plenty of optionality in the design that I think you don't have to change a lot of things fundamentally. So let's say the lower link, for example, that would give you plenty of options to, you know, you mentioned it, play with linkage, work on different leverage curves, different anti-squat, different this and that. And so I mean, I guess you could take some inspiration of, you know, whatever, Geometrons and Nikolai's and with their mutator stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
And just do simple optionality pieces that you can make longer chainstays, different shock lengths, different leverage curves, etc.
Yeah. Yeah, you have a lot of options. I think you could play around with just some pivot locations, or even just the position of the idler pulley on these high pivot bikes has a huge impact on the pedaling characteristics as well. And just half a millimeter just throws it off completely. So there's a lot of room to play around. Not running out of ideas anytime soon, I don't think.
Good. And just for the record, I think it looks absolutely amazing. And knowing the full backstory of this project just makes it so much better.
Cool. Thanks. I appreciate it.
I'm mega stoked that the head tube didn't snap off yet.
Yeah, so am I. Yeah.
And I want to be there when it happens.
It's for the listeners that don't know, that's a running gag between the three of us.
Yeah, I really hope if it happens, somebody captures it on video. So
you need to get a GoPro.
Yeah, maybe.
First person head tube snappage.
Yeah, does not sound fun.
Well, I guess with that, we can close it out. Reto, if our listeners want to reach out to you, they want to learn more. I just got a text message from Yeti. He's asking when you are taking orders. Where can they find you?
Probably Instagram would be the best. At Reto Abisher, I think.
Sweet. I'll put that into the show notes as well, so people can find it there. And I think with that, we close it out for the night.
Very cool.
It was a pleasure, as always.
Well, yeah, thank you, it was cool talking to you guys. Get onto a couple of tangents.
All right. Have a good night. Talk to you next time.
Ciao.
Ciao.
Thanks for listening. We really hope you enjoyed this episode. Why don't you let us know what you think? We really like to hear from our listeners. To find out how to get in touch with us, follow the links to our website in the description or find us on Instagram under @skitsandgiggles. Until next time, skigglers.